Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us for the latest episode, the latest edition of Life on Planet Porky. And there's been quite a bit happening on Planet Porky since we last communicated with the audience, Leslie Ann. Some of it really good stuff, some of it tragic stuff. And although you can't really call the death of a British icon tragic, because, of course, she had a wonderful life, it hit us right between the eyes, did it not, when we heard of the death of Dame Vera Lynn?
Well, you know, 103 is 103, but I was incredibly sad. I was privileged to have spent some time with Dame Vera filming a documentary in her house. And I had a wonderful...
Who did you do that for, by the way?
Oh, that was originally for Vintage TV, but because Vintage TV collapsed, it never aired. But we made it with Paul Gambaccini.
That's what I mean. Yeah, and you had a great professional team there. That's great.
Yeah, he and I have been talking, and we're going to try and resurrect it because we feel that.
Oh, you must do now. Yeah.
Yeah, this was the final interview that Dame Vera ever gave for British television.
Incredible.
And well, yeah, the public has a right to see it.
We've got a solid campaign to resurrect that without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah, we just need to raise the money to make it into a program, because what we have at the moment
will come along, believe me.
Yeah, but I think we will, because it's a piece that all British people should have the privilege of seeing.
Yes.
She was a remarkable woman. She was so ordinary and down to earth and so selfless. You know, during the war, she left behind her little girl, Virginia, back home and went out to sing for the troops in the Far East and so on. And she didn't demand special treatment. She had one uniform, one lipstick and a bar of soap. That's all she had.
Yeah.
She slept in a hammock slung between two chairs, and she ate her dinner nightly, was a bowl of rice with a spoonful of jam. And she didn't come on like a celebrity and demand to be treated like a diva.
Yeah.
She mucked in and she got down with the lads. And I had so much admiration for her. God rest her soul.
Absolutely fantastic. I have to say that my closest connection to Dame Vera Lynn is the fact that my father, who is a veteran of the Second World War, he joined when he was 17 in 1940, joined the Royal Navy. And he always said to me, till the day he died, and sadly he's been dead a long time now, nearly 40 years, but he always talked about, you know, when we had a few beers together, when I was an elder teenager, so to speak, you know, oh, you don't know, you've lived, son, oh, you know, you don't know about life, you didn't, you weren't sent to war when you were 17, all this kind of stuff. But every war story included some reference to Dame Vera Lynn, honestly. It was like she, you know, she just became not just the, you know, the Forces sweetheart, she became the Forces icon. And I didn't realise until I saw that documentary recently, Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover. There'll be bluebirds over the white... The bluebirds were the Spitfires. I didn't realise that. I thought she was actually talking about birds, and when troops were coming back from war, they would see these birds fluttering. No, what it meant was, you're safe now, you're protected, the Spitfires are here, you know.
Well, that's interesting, because she, I don't think she knew that. She talked about bluebirds in the interview that we did.
Yeah, but...
Bluebirds are a phenomenon of America. We don't have bluebirds here. But she was talking about them being sort of the winged creatures. So I'm not sure she even knew that that reference was to the plane.
Well, there you go. It's a bit like you writing your book on John Lennon. You know, people will be writing books on Lennon probably for another 50 years, and somebody somewhere will find some new amazing fact or story or something like that. You know what I mean?
Because there's always new information. Yeah, all you got to do is go there, go to Liverpool and dig around, which is what I did.
Exactly. Now, not wishing to make ourselves sound people of a certain generation, but Vera Lynn 103, But also, you in particular have been celebrating another birthday since we were last on air. Who was that?
Oh, Macca, Paul McCartney. God, I can't believe he's 78. Can you? He
no.
looks amazing.
Yeah.
I posted a picture actually on Twitter because I got to spend some time with him at LIPPA, the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, last summer. And I was in the green room with him and chatting about his wife, his late wife, Linda, who I was very close to. And yeah, had a lovely time. I just, you know, I've idolized that man since I was about 12. And meeting him in the flesh, it's no disappointment. He is just, well, he's the most successful rock recording artist and songwriter in the history of music.
And
it's incredible. And he's such a down-to-earth guy. I love him.
The greatest living, he literally is the greatest living English rock star and probably of all time.
And songwriter,
And songwriter, yeah, but probably of all time historically, but still living.
He lived forever. God, there's no one after him, is there?
No. I suppose, look, you know, it's horrible to say this, but being the business we're in, you know, we like drama, we like stories, and I'm fascinated by obituaries and all that. One of these days, and I think they will outlive me, the three critical rock star expirations of the next decade, and, you know, God forbid it's not the next decade, it's the decade after, are going to be Paul McCartney, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, without a shadow of a doubt. You know what I mean?
Well, and then we've got Elton John to come, of course.
Well,
we're not wishing them dead. You know,
they've got much
life in them yet.
Listen, some people live forever. I thought Dame Vera Lynn would live forever.
Do you think the Queen's counting the years now? How many years have I got left now?
Well, yeah, but there's some people you never imagine the world can exist without. And Paul McCartney is certainly one of those, you know. So, and Cliff Richard as well, of course, you know, is one of those.
I think he's immortal, though. He's not a human being, is he?
Well,
he defies gravity, that one.
I totally agree with you. Now, of course, we're still in COVID and all that kind of stuff. I'm looking for an easement, obviously, and hope the easement comes sooner rather than later. Somebody who you will know probably very well or know of, but I only know by reputation, has brought a lot of ire on herself this week, because I'm talking about Liz Hurley. And she also celebrated a birthday, 55th birthday, but she celebrated by jumping into a bath, waving her arms around, bubbles all over the place, glasses of champagne, isn't life wonderful? And she's got 1.6 million Instagram followers. They all love it, but a lot of other people thought it was churlish, rather cheap. The world's in a very serious place at the moment. Is the only thing Liz Hurley's got, has she got anything better to do than jump into bubbly baths and show everybody what a great time she's having, when so many other people are having a miserable time? Now, I don't know if you're a great associate of Miss Hurley, but what do you think about all that?
Well, I think it's pretty shabby, actually. It did remind me, did you see the piece in The Telegraph by a woman in Kensington who, she's you know, very rich, she's got nannies, she's got a private income, all of this.
Yeah.
And her first response to the lockdown was to treble her order of Freddie's flowers. See that?
That's right.
Just so out of touch with reality, which I think Liz Hurley also is.
Yeah.
You know, she's only famous for having worn a safety pin dress.
That's right. That's the only thing.
For her relationship with Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
For her engagement to Shane Warne, which lasted 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And she's been in one film that anybody can remember, which was the Austin Powers, was it International Man of
Mystery.
Something or other mystery. Yeah. 23 years ago. Why do we care about Liz Hurley, really?
I think she was in another film, and I keep having this debate with people. I think she was in a film called Passenger 57, which I watched on an aeroplane once, and it was about hijacking an aircraft, and it included Rickman. You remember that great actor, Alan Rickman?
Rickman, yeah.
And,
brilliant guy.
And her role was as a air stewardess, Dolly Trolley, as we called him in those days.
Trolley Dolly, even.
That's right, yeah. And Rickman was in first class, and she brought the trolley, which had a silver salver on it, to Rickman's seat, and said to him, how do you like your meat, sir? And he turned up the lid of the salver, you know, a domed like silver salver, you see what I mean? And
yeah.
With a gun there, he picked it out, shot somebody and said, bloody. And it was a a 45-second appearance by her, but I'm certain it was her. And I've spoken to film buffs about it over the years, and it was such a flashing sort of role that nobody can actually pin it down. But I think it's a bit harsh to sort of, you know, write her off and all that kind of stuff. I mean, she did make the very, very most of her initial flashbulb picture appearance with Hugh Grant, didn't she?
Well, she did, but she didn't have much to back it up with. And I'm not sure I think her fame actually is out of all proportion to her talent.
Yeah, I agree.
Why do we care so much about her? Her relationship with Hugh has been over for donkey's years.
Yes, that's right.
And that all fell off the side when he, well, I was about to say got into bed with, got into a car with the prostitute Divine Brown on Sunset Boulevard,
that's
wasn't
right.
it?
I was there. I was in Los Angeles.
So was I.
Oh, were
you? And I lost my job over that and got arrested over it. All kinds happened. So maybe that's why I'm a little bit averse to her. I don't know. The whole Hugh Grant connection is not a good one for me.
No. Well, okay. We'll talk about that later. I was in LA staying with Caroline Graham, right? My friend. And all of a sudden, all the phones went mad and all that, you know, and Hugh Grant had been arrested. Within hours, we'd ordered 1,000 posters with the picture of Divine Brown on it. And I was going up and down Sunset Boulevard and all the other boulevards with a bloke in a truck with a lorry, with a pair of ladders on the top and a hammer. And we were hammering wanted notices for Divine Brown because all the telegraph poles.
Yeah, but we had her. We had her in a hotel in the desert. The News of the World bought her up.
Right. Right.
So we had her away from all the rest of you. We killed the competition.
Right. Well, there you go. If I'd have known that I was in competition with you, I wouldn't have bothered, Leslie Ann, because I knew I could never win. But no, that you're absolutely right. And then after that, they staged this amazing picture when he came back of her having a new mattress taken into the house. Do you remember?
Just to wouldn't you change your mattress? Well, after that.
You would if your boyfriend had been found in a car with a lady of... notorious reputation, I think we should say. Anyway, there we go. Listen, talking about amazing women, and we've talked about quite a few already. Dame Vera Lynn and Liz Hurley, amazing or not, but she's certainly famous. But there was another birthday this week of a woman for whom I have enormous regard, and that is one of the Williams sisters, and I'm desperately trying to find out which one it was. Here we go. Because I can't believe the history of these two women. So Venus Williams is 40 this week. She's the 5 times Wimbledon champion. Her sister, that's the Wimbledon singles champion. Her sister Serena has won it 7 times. So that's 12 times altogether, right? And they're both about the same age, 40. I mean, can you ever think of a pair of more successful sisters in the history of the world if you go past the Bronte sisters? And that's about it, isn't it?
Well, I think it is, but I think it's not only that. It's the best sports story in history, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
What I didn't realise until recently, there are 5 Williams sisters. So I wonder what it was about these two.
Does that include the one who sadly died?
I'm not sure. Yeah, five born.
Yeah, oh, well, one of them sadly died about 10 years ago.
Okay. I wonder what it was about these two that, you know, because it was the father. It was all about the father. Wasn't
oh,
it?
An amazing
Richard,
guy.
Richard Williams, who had been a cotton picker in Louisiana.
That's right.
And had faced the Ku Klux Klan and all of this and had pulled himself up by his bootstraps and had gone to Chicago to make something of himself.
Yeah.
And it always reminds me a bit of the Michael Jackson story in a way, because Joe Jackson, who was the father, had lined up his kids and gone, what can I do with these guys to make money?
Yeah.
And he decided to turn them into a group and he was rehearsing them night after night after night. They used to go out and do gigs every night after school, get to bed at 2 and 3 in the morning, have to be back in school the next day.
Yeah.
And he used to belt them actually with a strap and sort of make them perform. But Michael was only about 5 years old when this started. Mm. And I think the Williams story is much the same, although Richard, he had a stroke, didn't he, quite recently? And
he's been out of the limelight for a while now. But
he's got dementia.
It's a quite remarkable story. He went into a shop and he bought a book on how to play tennis, a coaching tennis manual, literally. And when his daughters were little girls, he took them out to a tennis court, a public tennis court, and he And he, reading from the book, he told them how to use this tennis racket and all that. That's how it all started. It's utterly amazing because, you know, he could have done that for 30 years and they still wouldn't have won a game of tennis, let alone Wimbledon 12 times. It's the most amazing story. How could he possibly have detected or known that they'd be good at playing tennis?
Well, I think, you know, it's that old thing, isn't it? How much of it is talent and how much of it is hard work?
Yeah.
What he really taught them was courage and fire.
Yes,
and
maybe.
How to stick at it. Yeah. And that's got to be at least 50% of their success story, I would say.
No, I think you're right. And it worries me because I think, God, maybe I could have been so very, very successful at something if I'd have picked up a guitar, if I'd have got into a Formula One racing car, if I'd have got onto a pair of skis and gone down a ski jump or something like that. You know, what I'm saying is there could be a latent genius in all of us. The difficulty, the problem, is just trying to find it. I mean, for instance, have you ever played chess?
I can't play chess.
That's what I mean. So maybe if you had and you'd bought a book or your parents had bought a book and said, no, I'm going to teach you how to play chess, you might be a grand champion by now.
Well, I might be, but I think it is that. It's about sticking at something and doing it over and over and over, giving it your $10,000 and then another $10,000 until you are the best that you can be.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be good at everything, but if you happen to get lucky and find the one thing that turns your light bulb on, you know, bingo.
Yeah. No, I...
I'm no good at bingo either.
No, I'm not either. I can't stand bingo. I'm the most ridiculous pastime in the world. Paul Gascoigne used to play, you know, used to love playing bingo.
Did he?
Yeah. He used to drag his teammates out to bingo halls and all that all the time. I suppose it wasn't a huge intellectual challenge, not being rude to Paul Gascoigne, but he just liked the idea of, you know, shouting house, house, house and all that kind of stuff.
Now, two fat ladies and all that.
Two fat ladies and all that kind of stuff, yeah. It's been Royal Ascot week, Leslie Ann. Have you over the years been a Royal Ascot sort of debutante?
You know, I did go a couple of times. I used to work for a guy, Chris Wright, who owned Chrysalis Records.
Oh, yeah, I know,
He bred racehorses. And when we all worked at Chrysalis, he used to take us to Royal Ascot for a day out, you know?
Yep.
So you'd dress all up in the hats and the gear and stuff and
Brilliant.
Drink champagne all day until you couldn't say it. And yeah, it was a good old day out. But I wouldn't go as far as to get done up in my finery and sit with the champagne in front of the telly.
Yeah.
I think that's going a bit far, really, isn't
it? Yeah, I do. I think it's ridiculous. And it just shows how, you know, we've got to move faster too. We're all going mad. I think isolation drives people mad. You know, I've done some very strange things. I had a terrible experience yesterday because after summoning all my strength to allow three landscape gardeners to come here, they rebuilt my garden because just before lockdown, my fences got blown down by, do you remember we had a couple of storms, you know, really bad storms just before lockdown?
Yeah, we did.
3.5 months ago. I tore the fences down, so they've been propped up ever since by chairs and all that kind of stuff, you know. But also I needed all the plants doing because normally I have them done the weekend after Easter, you know, the winter.
Well, your cleaning lady does them normally, doesn't she?
Well, yeah, but this was a much bigger job. It needed a much, much bigger operation. She tends them when they're done, but this needed a wholesale renovation, you know. So the geography of my penthouse flat means that these guys could come in through the front door, they could turn right through the spare room, there's a sliding window there out onto the roof garden, they didn't need to see me, I could see them through the window of the kitchen and the lounge and just wave at them. We didn't have any physical contact, you know, so they did all that. And then, you won't believe it, about 3 hours after they'd gone, there was like a monsoon. I'm not joking. This was just yesterday, just 24 hours ago. And this monsoon absolutely belted down. It was bouncing off my windows, my cantilever windows. It was bouncing off the road outside. But what it did is it smashed to pieces most of the plants because when the plants come originally, they're not bedded in. They're in compost and they're left for a week or two, you know, to sort of flower and that kind of stuff. Then they come back and they bed them in. They weren't bedded in. They've all been massacred. I'm very upset, you know, because
I'm so sorry. So you have to do it again.
It's going to have to be done again because the soil's all over the patio. You know, I've got very expensive Italian tiles on the floor and they're all messed up. And dear me, a shocking thing. But then again, people have got much bigger problems in life than that. Now, have you ever had a problem Leslie Ann, let me ask you this.
Where are you going with this?
It's perfectly clean, don't worry. In our youth, in our earlier days, when we were aspiring journalists and making our way up and all that, you'd often live in different places. You might share a flat, you might share a house or something like that, you might rent a place and all that. And the one thing I've always dreaded all my life is noisy neighbours. So I'm just going to read this story to you. A couple who discovered their £615,000 dream house. I mean, that is a very expensive house in some parts of this country, right? You know, I know that London is special, but some people who've got a £615,000 house in places outside London are doing well. Had noisy bedsit tenants next door, and they've lost their conversation battle because they claimed that they should have been told that there was a block of bedsits next door in which the tenants were consistently and persistently noisy. PR boss Mulgrade and 52 and his wife Hannah thought they had bought the perfect village home from a guy called Mark Crook, but they claimed they were shocked by loud partying at the house adjoining their smart four-bedroom semi, excuse me, in a little village in Surrey. The house, they didn't realise, had been converted into four bedsits. They tried to sue the people who bought the house off for £100,000, but the claim was rejected by the judge. Now, that's a very, very sore, raw sort of nerve case for me, because I had a house once, which I bought, and it was what you could call a townhouse, you know, three floors, lovely, three bathrooms, big garden out the back, patio attached to the back with doors into the garden, all that kind of stuff. But the people who moved in next door were a nightmare. I had to get an order taken out against them. Have you ever had the noisy neighbour situation?
Well, I haven't. I read the story, and my first thought was, how can they have not known about the neighbours? Because nowadays you have to declare all that kind of thing.
Yes, you do.
So why did they lose this case? You have to fill in forms that say whether you've had any problems with your neighbours, yep, any problems with the police, the council, yep, all that kind of stuff. So if the couple who sold them the house hadn't declared all of those things, yep, they were negligent.
Yep.
So why did the other couple lose the case?
I've no idea. And you're absolutely right there. Now, when I had my situation, the problem was that the house next door had been rented by the Home Office, and the people occupying it were a bunch of junior prison governors at a jail in Surrey, some 10 miles away. So I had this horrific problem where I was dealing with the Home Office, not with the people in the house. You know what I mean? And do you know what you have to do? You're absolutely right. The minute you make a complaint to the local council, the council will send you round a machine to monitor the noise from your neighbours next door. But the minute you've done that, you're so right. If you then decide to sell the house, you have to declare that legally to any potential buyer that you've got a noise problem next door. So
something fishy has gone on here, hasn't it?
Something very fishy has gone on. I didn't. What I did was I went into a estate agent nearby. This is in Surrey. And I said, who's the manager here, right? And this guy came for, oh, hello. And I was kind of reasonably well known as a regular radio presenter at the time, you know. So I said, come on, we'll go to the pub and have a drink. So I told him what I wanted to do. I said, I want to get rid of this house, right? And I told him the background to it. And I said, but I know the way you guys work. And if somebody walks through the door, you say to them, I've got the absolute ideal property for you. This has just come onto our books. It's not going to stay very long. It's brilliant. I said, and if you do that, I will give you £5,000 cash in your hand. And he took the deal, and I got rid of the house in a week.
Seriously?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's no way I was going to stay. It was making my life an absolute misery. And I thought at some stage I'm going to break and I'm going to go round and kick their front door down. It'll become a legal incident or something like that, you know. So
you did it kind of, you didn't declare the noise pollution and all of that?
No, it was nothing to do with me.
I hope that doesn't come back to bite you in the bum.
No, it was nothing to do with me. By the time the house was sold, I'd never made a complaint. I knew exactly what was going on.
That's fair enough, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I got the estate agent to take the risk. I mean, a bit devilish, but, you know, desperate situations require desperate remedies.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Okay, Leslie Ann, as we're recording here, the rain is literally bouncing off my Velux windows. So although we should be at the height of summer, I think the longest day has been this week, hasn't it?
It has. And just stay dry. Don't go out there.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I like this weather.
I love it. I love the rain. Absolutely love it.
I do as well. What's that song from, you know, our youth, you know? Walking in the rain with the one I love.
Oh, Neil Sedaka, that was.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, okay, Neil Sedaka, yeah.
I'm like a little jukebox here, aren't I?
Yes, you are like a little jukebox. Absolutely right, yeah. And, you know, I can't stand baking heat. That's why I never go to the Mediterranean or anything like that. I don't like freezing rain because that's miserable. But rain that drops on your head from lovely trees which have flourished, you know, in the summer. There's a lovely walk I can take in a park nearby down a, it's almost down like a rotten road type thing, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. and the horses sort of trot by and all that kind of stuff. I think it's absolutely lovely. So I'm quite liking it. However, the sun will come back. And when it does, as you are a sunglasses wearer of repute, I've done my research on this, and the sunglasses of high fashion this summer are going to be huge D-shaped square glasses. They're apparently very flattering because they cover such a lot of your face. Now, that's not
very
flattering.
I was about to say, you know, no, the reason that they flatter every woman's face is because they cover it up, practically the entire face. But they do annoy me a bit, the sunglasses designers, because they change the in shape every year so that they can keep selling frames.
Well, of course they do. Yeah.
I've kept all mine, so I'm like Elton John. I've got two drawers full of glasses.
Oh, I see.
And I sort of bring them out. You know, they are prescription sunglasses, so I have to change the lenses if I want to resurrect that particular pair.
Yes.
So I do that with about three or four pairs every summer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do wear them sort of through the winter as well, because I think, you know, they look quite mysterious. And,
yes, I agree.
You know, I can sort of go incognito with a hat and glasses. Well, nobody knows who I am.
The problem with that plan is you've got to wait till the particular shape comes back into fashion. But if that's 4 or 5 years, then your eyes will have deteriorated, won't they? And so they won't be very
good. Yeah,
but
you can just get the lenses replaced.
Oh, get lenses replaced. I see, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But you're absolutely right about that. Of course they change. It's like football clubs change their shirt every year, so more parents will buy it. And by the way, on that, the really most mercenary one I've ever come across, right, was probably like yourself, because we are people of, you know, appreciate the history of our country. I'm always very generous at poppy time, okay? Which, of course, comes up in sort of November, doesn't it? You know, in autumn.
Yes.
So, you know, you get so fed up of people coming up to you in stations and all that kind of stuff, like a poppy, sir, and you've just bought one, but you haven't actually, you know, put it into your jacket, your coat. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll buy the big metal one, and you can put whatever you want in the box. And I said, I'll have metal one, £25. Thank you very much. Okay. And then I bought another metal one so that there was one on my Mac and there was always one on my jacket. You see what I mean? So yep. I thought I was really smart, because the following year, right, when it came round to Poppy Day, I thought, oh, I know what I can do, because I paid 50 quid for these two metal badges last year. I will just put them back on my clothing and off we go to work and I'll be left alone. Oh, no. A bloke at Victoria Station stopped me, sir, would you like a poppy? I said, oh, I've got the metal one, thanks. He said, yes, you have got the metal one, sir, but that's last year's metal one. I said, what? And they change the metal badge every year.
He was having you on, because there are various different kinds. I've got several designs of these metal poppies. And like you, I sort of paid over the odds for them when I bought them.
Yeah.
And my mother gave me a beautiful one last year that's got sort of gold leaves all around it.
Really?
And I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. Bring these out every year.
Yeah.
You can wear whichever one you like,
yeah,
you know, because you paid a lot of money for it.
Sure.
So, but it's always worth having a pocket full of pound coins, isn't it? Just to bung one in when you get hassled by these people, because the guys, the old soldiers who make these, and there aren't many of those guys left, they rely on these funds.
Well, they certainly do. You're absolutely right. I'm being a bit churlish there.
You're not. You're a very generous guy. You're not.
I'm not sure how long we'll all be carrying money around in our pockets, to be honest. I haven't used notes or coins, as I'm sure you haven't now, for about 3.5 months.
Well, that's true. And also, we're not having church services right now, but yeah. We did actually install little card machines in our church now, so you don't have to put money in the plate anymore.
Well, there you go. Stops people touching stuff, doesn't all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Talking about churches, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, of course, are you a patron of St. Bride's Church in Fleet Street?
I'm actually a member of the Guild.
Right.
So there is a Guild of St. Bride's which upholds worship and sort of helps to arrange services,
yeah.
That kind of thing. I've been a member of that Guild for about 20 years.
Right, I see. And a close colleague of ours, we talked about in our last podcast, Steve Stammers, has sadly died. Now, normally speaking, by route, there would be a service for Steve at St. Bride's and a memorial service and all that. But I understand they've got very expensive now. Is that right?
Well, yes, it isn't routine to have your memorial service there. It does cost a lot of money.
Most people I work with in senior positions in Fleet Street usually did, you know.
Oh, yes, of course. So editors and senior journalists,
yeah.
People like Hugh McElveny, recently,
right.
My dad's best friend.
Yes.
But it does cost a lot of money to have your memorial service there. So if you worked for a paper that will stump up the cost,
yeah.
You're lucky, I suppose. But my father didn't have a memorial service there. We had a private funeral elsewhere,
yeah,
for him.
Exactly.
But he is on the altar there. So there is a plaque on the altar for my dad.
Sure, sure. And the reason I mention churches is because I get sent a load of books all the time. And I got one sent to me called Stonemason, A History of Building Britain. And it tells the history of stonemasonry. Because one of the amazing fascinations of my life, Leslie Ann, is I have no idea how all the magnificent cathedrals in this country were ever built. They were built in times when there was no electricity. There were no even pulleys. There was no hydraulics. How on earth did those beautiful cathedrals like York Minster ever get built?
I know, it's fascinating, isn't it? But have you been out to Egypt and seen the pyramids?
No.
You know, they just about had the wheel. How the hell did they make those things? Architecture fascinates me. It always has.
Yeah.
I think the answer is that it took a long time
to
create those buildings. Hundreds of years. And also a lot of lives were lost,
yes.
Because there weren't health and safety measures, that,
yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But what amazes me is the spirit and human belief. If you start a project which you know is going to take a few hundred years to finish, A, you're not going to get any personal satisfaction from it. You're not going to get any personal reward. Nobody's going to name that church after you because it won't be built for 200 or 300 years. But how do you know the world will still be going in 200 or 300 years? You know, how do you know that the world won't have blown up? It takes an amazing commitment to say, as they did in the Middle Ages, right, lay the foundation stones of Chester Cathedral, and then 247 years later, it was topped off. I mean, it's just incredible.
Well, it's an act of faith, isn't it?
I
mean, you know, Christopher Wren designed and built St. Bride's Church.
Yes.
And we still talk about Sir Christopher Wren today. And in fact, the pub we used to drink in just behind in the passage there, is it the Old Bell or the Five Bells?
It's the Old Bell.
So the Old Bell was built to house the builders who created St. Bride's. That's where they lived while they were building the spire and so on.
I know. And the spire, of course, is the model for the wedding cake, isn't it? With all the tea.
It is, yeah. And there's a hotel in Tokyo that every time they create a wedding cake in the image of the St. Bride's spire, St. Bride's receives a royalty.
Yeah. Amazing. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Good. I'm delighted to hear that. Which is the... Is it the Winnie the Pooh books or something? Every time one's sold, a children's hospital gets the royalties for it or something like that. You know.
Oh, and maybe it's Great Ormond Street.
Great Ormond Street, that's right.
Oh,
yeah.
I think actually it's Peter Pan.
Peter Pan, that's it. Yeah.
J.M. Barrie's books, yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. The old coronavirus and COVID-19, I hope we're moving out of it, but a lot of businesses are not going to survive. And amongst those might be some pubs, some smaller pubs that, you know, haven't been able to just keep going, like kind of stuff. But I thought at the top end of business, because they're supported and patronised by very wealthy people in very wealthy parts of London, nothing would go wrong. I was devastated, even though I've never been there, to hear that Le Caprice, which is, I think, one of the most fashionable restaurants in the world, will never reopen. Leslie Ann, you must have been a regular patron of Le Caprice.
Well, I've been there many times, but I think this was misreported. So you can be undevastated about this.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Because the lease came up for renewal and Richard Caring, who's the now owner, he bought the place from Jeremy King, Mr. Restaurant. It's just that he's not reopening it in that location. He's moving it somewhere else.
Right.
So Le Caprice will still exist, but it will be elsewhere in London. So we'll have to go when it reopens.
Yeah, definitely. Mr. Caring has been getting pieces written in all the newspapers warning the government, you've got to get rid of the, you know, the 2 metre rule, bring it down to 1 metre. People can't dine in restaurants and all that kind of stuff. He's a very successful guy. He owns Annabelle's, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. I've met him a few times because he was married to a girl called, I think she was called Jackie. She was the sister of Pat Stead,
right,
who was a very, very lovely colleague of mine. She worked at CBS Sony for many years. She sadly died. Pat was married to Bruce Foxton in The Jam. So she was, you know, married a rock star. She had just a charmed life, really. But yeah. Sadly died a few years ago. So Richard lives in what they call Versailles up in Hampstead. He's got this palace that he lives in. He's absolutely loaded, this guy.
Yeah, good for him.
He's really very worried about his business empire. But, you know, he's speaking on behalf of a lot of restaurants and bars. But what I will say here is that the science behind this is if you reduce it to 1 metre, your risk of catching COVID goes up by 10.
Yeah, no, I know. The percentage factor of catching it and the report I read at 2 metres is 3%. It goes up to 18% if it's 1 metre and all sorts of stats like that.
Well, that's even worse. Yeah. So why would you even want to go in a restaurant or a bar right now?
Well, because I miss bars. I love English pubs and I want to get into pubs and I want them opened as soon as possible. And you're right that Mr. What's his name? Caring, is it?
Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's speaking for an industry, but successful guys don't like their businesses to be halted in full throttle. You know what I mean? I think even worse than that, by the way, a friend of mine, Mr. Bill Kenwright, who is he runs the world's biggest theatre impresario business, got productions on all over the world all the time. I mean, I was told today, I did a TV show earlier today in which it was discussed and revealed that there may not be any pantomimes this year. And
oh, yes, there will be.
I'm glad
it's not behind us.
Yeah. Well, you see, the point is, for a lot of theatres, I went to see my mate, what's his name, Tim, Tim Vine, great comedian. And I went to see him in Aladdin at the Fairfield Hall's Croydon last Christmas, okay?
Oh, I remember when you went.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I went to see him. He was great and all that. And drink afterwards and all that kind of stuff, although not much of a drink because it was a matinee I went to see and he was doing a show that night. But I talked to the guys there at the Fairfield Halls. Over a quarter of their annual income comes from the pantomime in December and January. And if they can't get those pantomimes up this year, there's going to be an awful lot of empty shell theatres for years to come. That's horrific.
It is a worry, yeah. Did you see Cameron McIntosh's letter that was published a couple of days ago as well?
Yes.
Basically saying that, you know, and he owns his theatres.
That's right.
But really, really saying that nothing is going to be open until next year.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of worried performers around. My son has just graduated from ArtZ, which is the major performing arts school in London.
Yes.
Thousands of these kids out there looking for work, but there aren't going to be any shows for them to be in.
Yeah, this is a real tragedy. You know, when you're just embarking on your career, you want to enter a buoyant market, not one that has got 100 people applying for every one role, even if there's one role.
Exactly. So, yeah, it'll bounce back and they'll find new ways of doing it because we're humans and we are adaptable and inventive.
Yeah.
And they will come up with a new way of presenting entertainment.
Yeah. Well, yes, they will. But a lot of that will be in an art and a craft, which some of these youngsters that you're talking about have not yet been trained into, have they?
Yeah, but they've got their talent. They've got their voices. Yeah. They've got their acting skills. They are very fast learners at that age
Well,
and very adaptable. You know, I've told you, I've already filmed 5 documentaries in my house contributed to since lockdown began. So around come the cameras, you know, my daughter sets them up, we line everything up and away we go. So there are new ways being developed all the time. So I'm not going to worry about these guys. They are supremely talented and I think they will get by.
Okay. Talking about theatres, films, all that kind of stuff, I read a piece very recently that, have you seen the film Russell Crowe got his Oscar for? Max, what was it called? Forgot now. Was it Gladiator?
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't. It's that kind of stuff's not my
cup of
tea, really.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, and I will have my vengeance in this life or next. Who can forget the stirring moment from Gladiator when the noble Roman general confronts his treacherous emperor? Now, okay, films aside, you don't want to go and see films with gladiators and all that. But
I don't like violent films.
No, you don't like violent films, but you do know a lot of actors and actresses. Apparently, it was the most difficult film ever to have been made because the individual actors, including one who died, who was the guy who was the, you know, brawling, drinking, Oliver Reed, okay, he kind of died halfway through it and they had to sort of, you know, put him back together in pictures and all that kind of stuff. But apparently this film took twice as long to make as it should have done because the guys were drinking and brawling all the time. Is that typical of a film set?
I don't think it is. I think you'd soon get kicked off a set by your director if you were behaving badly. In fact, people do get kicked off set. And not only the actors, directors also get fired for misbehaving. And one of the early directors on Bohemian Rhapsody was fired for all kinds of shenanigans going on.
That went on for about 10 years, didn't it?
Yeah, because they had, well, it was Sacha Baron Cohen was lined up to play Freddie originally, which I think would have been a mistake because that would have been a film about Sacha Baron Cohen playing Freddie Mercury.
Right.
He would have been too recognisable. You know, he wasn't a good actor in that he could convince us that he was Freddie, whereas I think Rami Malek was able to convince us.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, they don't stand for any nonsense because it costs a fortune and it takes a long time to make a film.
Yes.
So everybody needs to be professional. They need to be sober.
Yep.
I mean, I do know a few people who've done things like if they don't like their leading opposite, you know, their leading man or woman or whatever, they'll eat raw garlic before going on set just before they have to kiss them and that kind of thing. So there's quite a bit of mischief goes on.
Dinah Rigg, according to the James Bond actor, who only made one film, who I only ever refer to as Big Fry because he did an advert for Fry's Chocolate Delight.
That was George Lazenby, wasn't it?
George Lazenby. He always claimed in his autobiography, you know, his one appearance in James Bond, that Dinah Rigg used to eat garlic deliberately before they did any love scenes.
Well, who could blame her?
I thought it was a bit harsh. I thought he was quite good, but apparently he just got stardom syndrome. And when the film came out and it was, you know, received very well and all that, he then decided to revoke the contract he'd signed for 3 films on the basis that he wanted double or treble the money now. And, of course, Cubby Broccoli, the guy who ran it with a rod of steel, didn't he, said, no, get lost, and got rid of him. So all those things can happen. I had a mate during my long career in the media whose girlfriend, her job was to go to film sets, right, and I'm talking about big films, you know, I'm talking about, you know, high-budget films involving Tom Cruise and things like that. And she had to look after the whims and the needs of every important character in the cast. So, for instance...
Is that a euphemism when you say look after the whims and the needs of?
No, it's nothing to do with sexual favours or anything like that.
Oh, OK.
For instance, and I think the actor was Russell, what's his name?
Crowe.
Russell Crowe. If it wasn't, it was Johnny Depp or something like that. But I mean, really high power films. And so if I'm maligning any of those two gentlemen, my apologies, but it's just a great story. But one of them wouldn't do another day's filming until he'd had his Harley Davidson bike flown over from California to wherever they were. And it was somewhere like, you know, Kazakhstan or something like that. You know what I mean? Because he felt that he had to de-stress and had to get the wind in his hair and all that kind of stuff, and he wasn't going to do it on anybody else's bike except his own. And apparently, people right at the top of the industry can demand stupid things like that.
Well, it's because it's famous in the rock industry, isn't it? It's the contract riders, yeah, as they call them.
Yeah.
So you make specific demands which are accepted into your contract. So some of them, like Joan Collins, want the dressing room repainted in lilac,
yes,
before they'll use that. They want fresh flowers delivered every day. Well, that's, yeah, standard. Piles of white towels, you know. Or you get the rock bands that want bowls of Smarties with all the orange ones
that's
taken
right
out.
Yeah.
Or so much cocaine delivered every afternoon at 4 o'clock, or a specific, yeah, brand of champagne, or they, yeah, want sort of blonde groupies lined up.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Julio Iglesias, he always had a gaggle of about 12, I should call them young middle-aged women, sort of late 30s, early 40s,
yeah,
all buzzing around outside his dressing room door to make it look as though he had groupies.
Yeah.
But in fact, they were paid to do it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And did he indulge in physical recreation with them?
Not by then, no. He was over and done with all that.
Oh,
by
really?
Then, yeah.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
Too knackered.
He just wanted his ego massage, nothing else.
I see. So he was too knackered to get down to the old Rumpy Pompey and the horizontal refreshment, so he just made it look as though he was still in demand, did he?
I went in a car with him from Dusseldorf to Dortmund on tour,
yeah,
because I was doing an interview for You magazine.
Yeah.
And he said they said you can ride in the car with Julio after the show,
yeah,
going on to the next city for the tomorrow night show,
yeah,
but he won't allow you to make any notes or record anything.
Yeah.
Oh, so this is great, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I have to sit in the back seat of the car and ask him all these questions, commit it all to memory.
Yeah.
And then the second we got to the hotel at the other end, I rushed into the ladies,
of course,
and just dragged out my notebook and wrote down everything I could remember.
Yeah.
But that's pretty stupid, isn't it? Because if they want accuracy in an interview,
yeah,
they've got to let you record it,
yeah,
or write it down.
That's right, yeah. But what was Julio like anyway?
A bit flaky, you know, sort of not very attractive close up.
Right.
I felt he was a bit over the hill by then.
Yeah.
I liked his voice in the early days, but because then his son came along.
Forever and ever you'll be.
I think you'll find you're thinking of Demis Roussos.
Oh, am I? Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Easy mistake to make.
Yeah, yeah.
But Julio got overtaken by his son Enrique Iglesias,
yeah,
didn't he?
And did, yeah,
then,
yeah,
it was kind of all over for him.
Yeah. Yeah. He wore the worst hairpiece, didn't he? And had the most ridiculous orange, you know, tan or whatever.
Yeah, he did.
But it used to be.
Don't you think any male hairpiece is the worst hairpiece, really? I think men just can't get away with it, can they?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And his saving grace is he used to be he was a goalkeeper for Real Madrid, and he only went into singing because he got an injury which put him out of football. I don't think he was ever Real Madrid's number one goalkeeper, but he was certainly on their books, you know. So
it's on his CV, isn't it?
Yeah, well that's right. So we forgive him for that. Well, Leslie Ann, sadly it seems like we've been talking for 10 minutes, but we haven't. We've gone through the length of another podcast, but that's great. And once again, I'm sure you'll join me in my thanks to all the people who send us all these lovely comments. And you know, if you've got an unlovely comment, send us an unlovely comment, because we can only learn by our mistakes if we're making them. Do you not agree?
Oh, of course. And thanks to that lovely guy who sent us a message all the way from Kerala in,
yeah,
India. It's lovely to hear from him this week. Kerala in India.
Oh, where's that?
The Malabar coast.
Oh, right. Do you know India?
Yeah. I've been a couple of times. Yeah, I did a book festival in Mumbai a couple of years ago. Yeah. I mean, it's a culture shock. It's a
yeah,
all kinds of shock, really.
Yeah, sure.
We'll talk about India another time. That's
indeed
a whole programme, isn't it?
Indeed, it certainly is. Okay. Right, okay, Leslie Ann. Well, anyway, thank you very much. Thank you to all our people, all our listeners, and they can get hold of you where?
On Twitter at LAJWriter.
That's right. And get hold of me at MikeParry8. That's the Twitter one. And, of course, we have a universal address, which is planetporkypod@gmail.com. I want to thank everybody indeed for joining us. We'll be back with you again very soon.
So some of them, like Joan Collins, want the dressing room repainted in lilac,
yes,
before they'll use that. They want fresh flowers delivered every day. Well,
yeah,
that's standard. Piles of white towels, you know. Or you get the rock bands that want bowls of Smarties with all the orange ones
that's
taken
right
out.
Yeah.
Or so much cocaine delivered every afternoon at 4 o'clock. Or a specific brand of champagne. Or they,
yeah,
want sort of blonde groupies lined up.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Julio Iglesias, he used to have He always had a gaggle of about 12, I should call them young middle-aged women, sort of late 30s, early 40s,
yeah,
all buzzing around outside his dressing room door to make it look as though he had groupies.
Yeah.
But in fact, they were paid to do it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And did he indulge in physical recreation with them?
Not by then, no. He was over and done with all that by then, yeah.
So I said, come on, we'll go to the pub and have a drink. So I told him what I wanted to do. I said, I want to get rid of this house, right? And I told him the background to it. And I said, but I know the way you guys work. And if somebody walks through the door, you say to them, I've got the absolute ideal property for you. This has just come onto our books. It's not going to stay very long. It's brilliant. I said, and if you do that, I will give you £5,000 cash in your hand. And he took the deal. And I got rid of the house in a week.
We had her away from all the rest of you. We killed the competition.
Right. Well, there you go. If I'd have known that I was in competition with you, I wouldn't have bothered, Leslie-Ann, because I knew I could never win.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12-powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.